It is so good to be in the house of God. We sang, be silent, the Master is here. Who is your Master? Is he here today? Have you met him? Have you seen him? You can open your Bibles to Romans chapter 12. One of the things that I hope all of us realize is that we are leaky vessels. And I just want to give you a little review, or a quiz maybe, before we get into the sermon today. How many of you remember what Brother Jeff preached about last Sunday? Thank you. Blessed to be blessed. Blessed to bless. Is that what it was? How many of you had an opportunity to bless people this week? You don't have to raise your hand, but I want you to think about it. One of the things that I think about sometimes is how quickly a sermon can fade from my mind, can last for a couple of days, and then I forget. And a sermon like that is not for Monday and Tuesday following the Sunday it was shared. It's for a lifetime. Looking for ways to bless people. Look at Romans chapter 12. Verse 14, bless them which persecute you, bless and curse not. And this moves into today's sermon. But I want us to just stop and think about, probably nobody persecuted you this week. I don't assume. It doesn't happen real often, but it does sometimes. But even if it does, bless them. Because you're blessed. Because I'm blessed. Bless and curse not. Rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep. Be of the same mind one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate. Be not wise in your own conceits. Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, bless him, right? Feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. The biblical basis for the doctrine of non-resistance, part two. I'd like to finish up what we were not able to finish before I went to Bible school. I enjoyed teaching 11 lessons, I guess it was, on the doctrine of non-resistance at Bible school. And perhaps what impressed me the most about it is that a doctrine can often trip us up when we say, oh, this doctrinal stuff is deep and hard to understand. The doctrine of non-resistance is so practical. It affects my life in so many practical ways. And I'm thankful for the reminders that I have, the fresh reminders of being aware of how it matters, how I respond to situations that come my way, especially difficult situations or when people take advantage of me, or at least I think that they do. It matters how I respond. It matters. Bless them. Tremendous challenge. Much easier to talk about than to do, but let's talk about it and do it. You can also turn over to Matthew chapter 5, where we find Jesus' teachings on this. I just want to read these verses again. We get this big word, non-resistance, from Jesus' words, where he says, resist not evil. And let's just take the time to read Matthew 5, 38 to 42 yet as well. This is a Sermon on the Mount. Jesus' own words, he says, ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. And Jesus kind of fleshes out this whole concept. How do you resist not evil? it's more than just the negative sense where we just refrain from doing something, but instead we bless and we pour on and we make choices that are the opposite of that. My mind went back to, I'll give you a little personal illustration, went back to the day that we bought our first house. We bought our house at an auction, and that very same day, before we had left, we had a neighbor that came over, who was going to be a neighbor, and she said, "Welcome to the neighborhood, but I want to warn you, there's a neighbor down there that you want to really watch out for. In fact," she said, "I'd encourage you, one of the first things when you move in, one of the first things you should do is put up a fence right on the property line, because he will infringe on your property. He will come across and he will take advantage of you." And I said, "Well, there's a challenge." What an opportunity. And I can just, I'm sure we didn't always make the best choices. I hope that we did. We were able to, I can testify to being good friends with this older couple. They became like grandparents to our children. And yeah, there was a few rough edges maybe that we had to just grin and bear, but God was good. And it takes two to fight. And God can bless your choices when you reach out in kindness, not revenge. You look for ways to bless other people. Non-resistance, what does it actually mean? We said that non-resistance is the term which in Anabaptist Mennonite history has come to denote the faith and life of those who believe that the will of God requires the renunciation of warfare and other compulsive means for the furtherance of personal or social ends. And that's just a really long definition. But renunciation of warfare, and not just renouncing warfare, but other compulsive means for the furtherance of personal or social ends. So there's a lot of little ways that I could choose to use compulsion to force people for my own benefit, for my own good. And we believe that Jesus says, no, don't do that. That's not the way that I lived. And so we looked at how, yes, it's not just resisting the evil, but it's being peacemakers. It's the New Testament doctrine of going the second mile and blessing other people, taking joyfully the spoiling of our goods. That's what non-resistance is really about. We talked about the struggle and this difficulty, because there's a disparity among Christianity. It's not always, those who profess Christianity don't always see this the same way that we see it. We also, one of the things that we didn't talk about, that we did talk about at Bible school, is this inborn tendency that God gave us for self-preservation. So there's this tendency that I think God put there where we fight for life. You think about a premature baby that's born and how fragile they are, and yet they fight to hang on to life. You think about when we get sick and the things that we do to preserve life, and we fight for our own lives. You think about the reflexes and the way that we duck and we blink our eyes because we want to preserve life. That's put within us. Ephesians 5:29 says, "No man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it." It's something that God has put within us. But the problem is, here's the struggle. The problem is when that desire or that feeling, that tendency is controlled by the carnal nature. When we selfishly want to preserve beyond life, we want to preserve our reputation, we want to preserve our rights, we want to preserve, okay, and we take this too far, and then we begin to retaliate and we respond in ways that the followers of Jesus should not. That's the struggle that we deal with. We looked at the New Testament basis. I already read the words of Jesus. We have the examples in Jesus' life. We have the example of the apostles, the teaching of the apostles. We have the stories like Paul and Silas, who chose to sing in prison, who chose to stay there when their chains fell off. These are things that we learn from. I think we ended at the fourth section, if I remember correctly. And so I would like to move on to part five. The New Testament versus the Old Testament. And just talk about this a little bit, because this is one of the things that can tend to trip up people. They say, well, you start reading the Bible from the front cover and you find all kinds of stories about war. And even Jesus said that you heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. And we go to the Old Testament and we say, wait a minute, there's something different going on. Well, there was something different. There has been a distinct change from the Old Covenant to the New Covenant. And I just want to look at some of those things. In the Old Covenant, just to help reinforce in our minds that Jesus issued in a new way of dealing with these issues. We have in the Old Covenant, Israel being a family. It started with a person, right? The children of Israel was a physical family. And people were born into that family, and you became an Israelite by birth. You have the seed of Abraham growing, as God promised, like the sands of the seashore. The New Testament parallel to, not necessarily replacing, and not even necessarily the same, but the New Testament parallel to Israel is the church, right? The New Testament church, the new creation, and the privilege that we have to be born again into the kingdom of God. So you have that difference. You have, like we said, the physical versus the spiritual. Israel versus the church. You have just a few more differences. You have an earthly king in the Old Covenant versus a heavenly king. And I think that it would be good for us to just read where Jesus talks about that and see some of that confusion that people had a hard time understanding. Turn to John chapter 18, where Jesus is discussing this whole concept with Pilate. John chapter 18, and we'll start at verse 33. Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus and said unto him, art thou the king of the Jews? Did Pilate know what a king was? Sure he did. And he looked at Jesus and he said, wait, people are calling you a king? But you don't look like a king to me. Are you a king or aren't you? And you see this struggle in his mind. Well, what's going on? Jesus answered him, sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it thee of me? Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? Now listen to these words of Jesus. Jesus answered, my kingdom, when there's a kingdom, there's a king, right? My kingdom, he's claiming it. So he's saying, I'm a king. Yes, I am a king. But my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom, were of this world, then would my servants fight. I would have servants and they would fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But that's not how it is. But now is my kingdom not from hence. It's not from the world. It's not a visible throne. It's not a king with servants and swords. Pilate therefore said unto him, well, art thou a king then? Still having trouble with this. Jesus answered, thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. Pilate saith unto him, what is truth? This is hard for him to grasp. This is a change. This is something new that Jesus is introducing. And Jesus is clearly establishing what we call the two kingdom concept. Jesus says, yes, there is a king. I am a king. I have a kingdom. But it's not the kind that you are used to seeing. It is something different. And this two kingdom concept, being a part of his kingdom, is so foundational to understanding non-resistance and our choice to lay down arms. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight. We also have, again, looking at the differences, we have the priests in the Old Covenant, and then we have the New Covenant where we are called a royal priesthood. Again, we see this parallel. It's similar, but it's a shift. It's a change. 1 Peter 2:9, but ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people. He's setting us apart and saying, yes, you are still a kingdom, as it were, but not gathered in a city with arms. You are a holy nation, a peculiar people, spread abroad among the world. But why? That ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. And that's what we move into, not into the White House or into the king's presence, as it were, or into his castle, but we move into the light of his presence and we live in that. The Judaizers that we saw in our lesson this morning, Galatians 1, they stumbled at this. They had a hard time seeing the change from the priesthood to the holy priesthood, to the royal priesthood. The other change that I want to point out yet is that we see in the Old Covenant that God's people, one of their purposes was to carry out God's wrath. It was one of the things that God asked them to do. Whereas in the New Testament, we have the proclamation of God's offer of salvation being for us. It's our duty to proclaim that. Which moves us into a little bit more of the Old Testament perspective. Let's look at how God's purposes were carried out in the Old Testament. God did not intend for his people to be non-resistant in the Old Covenant. I'll just make that statement right here. I believe that non-resistance was not a part of the Old Covenant. There were times where we got glimpses into the heart of God, and we saw his heart of love. But primarily in the Old Testament, his people were not called to be non-resistant. In fact, they were required to use the sword to execute their enemies as well as sinners within the camp. We have a prime example of that in Exodus, where Moses came back down from the mountain and Aaron had just thrown the gold in and a calf had come out, right? That's what he said. And they were worshiping it. And God set the stage, as it were, and he said, you know, either you're on my side or you're against me. And the Levites went through the camp and they killed the sinners within the camp. We also have, think about a few of these men. These men, each of them that I mentioned are, could we call heroes of the Old Testament? Men that we look up to. Think about Samuel. God asked Samuel, or Samuel hewed Agag, the king, to pieces before the Lord when Saul had failed to do so. This was before the Lord. I mean, it's really foreign to us. Joshua commanded to fight with Amalek. You think about Joshua going up to Jericho. There's a lot of bloodshed going on. These are people that we look up to as heroes. David, a man after God's own heart, killed Goliath in the name of the Lord. Elijah called down fire from heaven and consumed his enemies. Jeremiah prayed for the destruction of his enemies. This was part of the Old Covenant, and we have to make that distinction. There was a change. Now, one of the things that we stumble at, perhaps, is that we look at Jesus' words where he says an eye for an eye, and we say, oh, so they were allowed to retaliate in the Old Testament. Were they? Were they allowed to retaliate? Were they allowed to kill in anger and just, if someone mistreated me, I can just turn around and get them back? Is that true? We have the Ten Commandments that say, thou shalt not kill. But wait a second. We just read a whole list of men who were men of God who killed in the Old Testament. How do we reconcile that? I think one of the easiest ways to reconcile that is to go to Jesus' words in the New Testament. In Matthew 19, you could read this for yourself. We won't turn there. But when the rich young ruler came and said, what do I need to do? Jesus said, or rich young man, I guess it was, Jesus said, have you kept the commandments? And he said, which ones? Jesus said, thou shalt do no murder. And he explains for us that killing, when God gave the commandment, thou shalt not kill, he meant thou shalt not murder. And we have this difference between lawful killing and unlawful killing. They weren't allowed to just retaliate and get back. We have the cities of refuge that we've studied, and you know about them. And these were places where people could go to avoid the quick wrath and retaliation and allow for a proper ending or a proper judging of the matter. The other thing that I think we need to understand, of course, God has not changed. He's working with his people in a different way. But so we look at the Old Testament and the New Testament, God is not non-resistant. Maybe that sounds strange to you. But God is holy and God is perfect. And when God moves in vengeance, he says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. And when he moves in vengeance, he exhibits his holy wrath. It's not unrestrained retaliation for a personal offense like we tend to think of. It is holy wrath. And when he moves in mercy and grace and forgiveness, he does so with holy love. And those two are inseparable. They're just part of God's nature, part of who he is, his holy wrath and his holy love. And to us as humans, it may seem contradictory, but it's not. It's not. It is part of the perfect character of a holy God. We may never fully understand that on this side of eternity, but God is not bound by the carnal desires that we have of revenge. He moves in holiness and perfection. The other Old Testament glimpses into God's heart. I think that as we think about non-resistance, Jesus' teaching on non-resistance, we get some glimpses of that in the Old Testament. Think about Isaac and the wells that were taken away from him, right? He said, I'll just move on. They can have it. And he dug another well, and then they took it, and he moved on. And we have the life of Joseph, who forgave his brothers. He didn't respond harshly. Yes, he tested them, but he spoke kindly toward them. We have the Levites, who were a type of, I think in some ways, a type of the New Testament church, who were exempted from going to battle when the rest of the tribes went out. We have David, who was a man of war, and God saying, I want your son to build the temple, because you're a man of war. And again, gives some glimpses into his heart. I think God's heart of love and forgiveness certainly come through. And then we have plenty of prophecies in the Old Testament as well of peace. You could read through Isaiah, and there's lots of prophecies of a time of coming peace. And Jesus was called the Prince of Peace. And so we again see into the heart of God. Well, that's kind of a really quick rundown, but let's talk about a couple things in conclusion yet. Christian non-resistance is more than a refusal to engage in military service or participate in war. That's one of the things that we believe. As Mennonites, as Anabaptist people that we've chosen, as we try to interpret scriptures, we agree not to. But it's so much more than that. It is founded on the way of love, and particularly the way of the cross. And I want you to get this. Non-resistance is founded on the way of the cross. It's founded in the footsteps of Jesus, who walked out of a heart of love and a will to do the will of his Father, a desire to do his will. He walked to Calvary, and he walked to the cross, and he gave up his own self. He gave up his own will, not my will, but yours, Father. That is the foundation of what we also want to live out. It's that foundation of love. Jesus Christ, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten. And in doing that, he gave not only his disciples, but he gave us an example that we should walk in his footsteps. The doctrine of non-resistance holds that the Christian disciple must enter into this same experience with Christ. I can't emphasize this enough. As you think about what it means to be a follower of Jesus, we can look at all of his teachings. Some of them we have practiced from little on up, and maybe they're not that hard. Some of them are difficult to know. You look at Jesus' teachings on the kingdom and Jesus' teachings on wealth, and it's hard to sort through some of those issues. But the doctrine of non-resistance teaches us that the Christian disciple must enter into the same experience with Christ, being crucified with him, following in his footsteps, forgiving like he forgave, not returning, not retaliating, not resisting the evil intentions of men. I know that raises a lot of questions. It's hard to know. But it's the footsteps of the master, and they're the footsteps for the disciple as well. As God through Christ reconciled men unto himself, he gave us also the ministry of reconciliation. He makes an appeal of love to the world through the Christian. We are salt. We are light. We are not in ourselves the message. We are not the gospel. But we season that gospel. We spread that gospel. We reflect that light. And we do it by reflecting the life of our King, the life of our Master, our Rabbi, right? The one who did not repay evil for evil, the one who did not avenge himself, the one who loved his enemies, the one who prayed for those who persecuted him. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. This is the way of love. This is the way of the cross. This is the way of Christ. And it led to his death, ultimately on Calvary. And so one of the things that we need to face fair and square as we think about this issue, we talked about this tendency for self-preservation. And one of the big questions that comes up in our minds when we face the practical outworkings of non-resistance is, but what would I do if somebody threatened my life? What would I do if somebody threatened the life of my family? What would I do if they threatened my wife or my children? What would I do? Again, we have this inborn tendency for survival, for self-preservation, for protecting ourselves and the people who are dear to me. And we ask questions like, how much could I do? Or how far could I go without violating Christ's teachings? What if someone's suing you? What all can I do? What if someone steals from me? How far can I go in trying to get that back? What if someone rips me off in a business deal? How much can I say or should I say? And we raise these questions, and they're hard to answer. I think the better question to ask is, as I face life and as I face situations or maybe even just thoughts of what could come, how can I best represent Christ? How can I best show who Christ is to the world? Christ died. And one of the things that I told my students, and I'm still trying to believe it myself, I think that I do believe it, but it's hard to reckon with. But we think that, well, the worst possible thing that could happen is that I would die or they would die. But let me just remind you, the worst possible outcome is not death. That's not the worst possible thing that could happen to us or to them. You think about how many times God used the death of people to bring others to himself. Think just alone of the life of Jesus, the death of Jesus, and how it's through his death that we find salvation. Think about how many times it was said of the martyrs who were persecuted that the blood of the martyrs was the seed of the church. It's what spread the gospel. It's what propelled people to come to grips with life and the reality of God and whether I'm going to submit to Him or not. Because here's somebody that had a faith that was worth dying for. They didn't resist. They went to the cross. They went to the fire. They went to the wild beasts. Death is not the worst possible outcome. If we can settle that in our minds, we'll be much further in dealing with the other questions of what can I do or what would I do or what should I do. There's so many examples that stories we could read about. I think we have time. Let me just read a couple that I think help to just show some real people in real life who made hard choices, but the right choice, that showed that they believed in the doctrine of non-resistance and they believed in walking in the steps of Jesus. Some years ago, Jacob, a Mennonite farmer, decided to replace his small chicken house with a large modern one. Having gotten the necessary permits, he made plans to begin building. The bulldozer, the grader, the truck, and the tamper moved in and began preparing the site. After getting a good start on the first day, the operators parked their equipment at the end of the field. That evening, Jacob's telephone rang several times. "You're not going to build a big chicken house right here in our backyard, are you?" asked one neighbor. "We never hoped that one of those chicken factories would come to our small town," said another. Jacob enjoyed his good neighbors, even though many of them did not profess to be Christians. The small town that his farm bordered provided a quiet, friendly environment for him to raise his family. After a few such calls, Jacob said to his wife, "Maybe we made a mistake. We should have talked to the neighbors before we started." Later that evening, Jacob called the excavator and told him to hold off the digging. "You're not going to stop now, are you? You have all the permits. We've put in a day's work. We'll have to charge you for it and for moving all the equipment." "Just hold off," Jacob replied. "I'm not interested in getting my neighbors upset at me." After a few days of talking with the neighbors and asking advice from some of his church brethren, Jacob called the excavator again. "Return the ground to where it was and put the topsoil back again. We're going to make this site into a field again." When the excavator protested, Jacob explained, "Having obtained the necessary permits, I know that I would have the right to continue with the chicken house as we had planned. But the law of love compelled me to do differently." And that was adapted from a story that Dennis Bennett wrote in The Home Horizons. The law of love compelled me to do differently. We will face situations. It may not be putting up a chicken barn, but what are we going to do when our rights are being weighed with the law of love and living at peace with all men? Those can be really, really tough, especially when it affects our pocketbooks and our bank accounts. It can be really, really hard. Let me read you one more story. This happened out in the Chambersburg area. Anyone that's from that area is familiar with Letterkenny, which is an army depot. On December 7, 1941, Japanese warplanes attacked Pearl Harbor. In response, the United States hastily entered World War II. 1 month later, in January 1942, the government seized 21,000 acres of Letterkenny Township, which is in Franklin County near Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, for service as an ammunition depot. The farms of 10 Mennonite families, as well as the Strasburg Meeting House, were within the seized area. One elderly widow, Katie Burkholder, was given only 2 days' notice to vacate her home. One member, writing of the experience, later said, "We felt sad to leave our place of worship, but were strengthened when we thought of how our forefathers met their problems. The Lord made a place for us. There was a vacant church belonging to the Church of the Brethren standing out of the area that was taken, and through their kindness, they gave us that church. The Bosler congregation of Western Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, faced a similar threat. At the same time, Army officials came knocking on the doors announcing their intentions of taking 11,520 acres for a TNT project. Local people watched incredulously as engineers, surveyors, and appraisers in cars with out-of-state licenses moved about through the countryside. What would you do if they moved in here and they set up their transits and they started measuring out? In response, local officials appealed to the government to reconsider. They sent a delegation of 10 local dignitaries to meet with Pennsylvania officials and with the War Department in Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, the Mennonites met at the Bosler Meeting House for a special morning prayer meeting. Minister Simon Garber addressed the gathering. "We are resigned to the will of the Lord. This government has been good to us. It has protected us. If we must give up our homes, it means heartache and hardship, but we are ready. We will not pray that this burden be lifted from us and placed upon the shoulders of others." Think about that. It is our task. If it is our task, we pray for faith to carry the burden. Perhaps this is a blessing in disguise. Perhaps our testimony is needed somewhere else. I want to make it clear that this is an unconditional surrender to the will of the Lord and the desire of our government. And that is a tremendous testimony. When we pray for these situations, can we actually pray that God would use this circumstance? Not necessarily pray for it to be removed, but that God would use it for His glory and maybe to spread the faith further. As a closing song, the congregation sang Faith of Our Fathers. While the prayer meeting was in session, someone sent a telegram to the delegation at Washington, then meeting with Lieutenant Colonel J.P. Harris. The sender wanted to inform the delegation that right now, while they were negotiating, people back home were praying. As the telegram was read aloud, the typewriter stopped and there was an expressive silence. Colonel Harris then told the delegation to go home and tell the folks their prayers are answered. There's no intention of taking that site for now. Within 10 days came the official announcement that the Army planned no further action so far as the Lancaster site is concerned. On Sunday evening, the Mennonites gathered for another special meeting at the Bosler Meeting House, a meeting of thanks. But Minister Martin Crabo was quite disappointed to see considerably fewer persons attending than at the earlier gathering. The power of prayer. Prayer has a way of changing not always our situation, but our attitude toward the situation. And as we think about difficulties that could come, that would test our non-resistance, let's never forget in the power of prayer. But I want to encourage us that the only way that power in prayer will be realized in those times is if prayer is meaningful to us today. That we are accustomed to taking our burdens to God and leaving them there and allowing Him to change our hearts, even if our situation doesn't change, and help us to find joy and peace in those situations. That is God's desire for us, that through our walk, through our practical outworking of the teaching of Jesus, that the gospel would go forth and that we could make an impact, that we could be a light and a salt in this community. God help us to do that. Let's kneel for prayer.